Ready to take your verdicts and jury selection to the next level? Jury consultant Harry Plotkin and trial lawyer Dan Kramer are your ticket to tipping the scales before trial begins. You're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to another episode of Picking Justice. Harry, I gotta say, I am very excited. I've been looking forward to this episode in particular because not only do we have the godfather of trucking cases who tries cases throughout the country, who sees a lot of different juries and a lot of different jurisdictions, handles different judges who have different requirements. He's gotten so many eight-figure verdicts. I'm looking at his website, too many to even list here, countless seven-figure verdicts. A great guy. He was one of my teachers at the Jerry Spence Trial Lawyers College. But most importantly, he's our first guest that is a fellow Atlanta Braves fan from Atlanta, Georgia, Joe Freed. Joe, how you doing? Go Braves, man.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on here. I'm really excited to have a talk with you guys because you guys are doing this right. And I appreciate why you're doing this. It's been needed and it's a great topic and there's so much to learn. So I look forward to giving whatever I can give, but also learning what I can learn today and through the rest of the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking earlier. I mean, one of the best things about kind of hearing from you, I mean, we've talked to a lot of great Southern California trial lawyers who try cases, you know, throughout California, some go out of state, but you're kind of everywhere, right? I mean, aren't you trying cases basically in the whole country now?
Yeah, I'm going all over the place. I don't know. I have to count the states that I've actually tried cases in, but I've handled cases in 43 states. So I've got an interesting perspective when it comes to that. And, you know, I've learned a lot because from going different parts of the country, not only are there differences in juries, but there's huge differences, as you've already, you know, mentioned, with every judge has their own proclivities. And of course, every jurisdiction has its own proclivities and rules. And you have to figure out how to best go about this thing called jury selection, which is just an underappreciated art, I think, frankly.
Well, I think it's, again, this is why we're doing this podcast. I think it is the hardest thing to learn. It's always evolving, right? I mean,
I think it's a way of life, Dan. I mean, I really do. I think jury selection is life. I mean, I know that sounds crazy.
Yeah.
Like if I was a golf pro, I'd say golf is life. I'm a trial lawyer, so jury selection is life. But it really is. I mean, it has to do with the way you live your life.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I just to touch on is that you said juries are different. You know, I mean, you see a lot of different juries throughout the country. I mean, I've only tried cases in California, different parts of California. And of course, you know, in California, you think Orange County is more conservative or, you know, some parts of the Bay Area, surprisingly, may be more conservative. You get way north or Fresno, who knows? But LA County, you know, pretty liberal and all that stuff. And I imagine throughout the country it is, but are you finding that the range of jurors, that people in general are really that different?
Like, no.
Is it really that? Yeah.
So look, I mean, people within any community, you're going to find, I think, a broad range of people with different ideas and whatever else. But the magic of doing what we do is to build a case around the things that make us the same, not the things that make us different. So actually, that's what jury selection is. You've already hit on kind of my whole philosophy of jury selection is to say, how can we coexist as not a homogeneous group? We can be totally different in our politics, in our thought processes, and all these other things, but we can come together on the things that are necessary to do justice in this case. And those things, I think, are universally the same everywhere. I mean, you can't go to any place in the country. And if you query in the right way, you know, and you start asking people, what are the things that are most important to you in your life? You're going to hear family everywhere. You're going to hear freedom everywhere. You're going to hear independence everywhere. You're going to hear self-determination in some form everywhere. It may come out as a pickup truck in one part of the country and a sailboat in another part of the country. But what's represented by that sailboat and what's represented by that pickup truck are really the same human, deep level kind of a thing. So to me, that's what jury selection is about, is reminding people that we're really the same on the things that matter in this case and honoring all the differences, you know, kind of making room for the differences so that we can focus on the things that are the same.
Because you hear, you know, you're like, there's no way you're ever going to get an eight-figure verdict in South Georgia, for example. And I remember you and I did a case analysis or whatever we did on, I think you represented a Muslim family, right? Whose the dad was seriously injured. He was a quadriplegic or something like that.
Brain injury case.
Yeah, really tragic. But I love the way you presented that. Even your own kind of, you see this family for the first time and you had some judgment in you. I just love to hear kind of how you approached that because you got an amazing result. It was in Southern Georgia, wasn't it?
It was in Atlanta. Part of Atlanta, but it was in Newt Gingrich's home county.
That's what it was. Right.
So it was, the short version of it is a perfect example of what we're talking about is what are you making the case about and making room for, but what you were talking about is sort of a different thing than jury selection in this case is to something that I like to do is I like to model for the jurors, right? So in that, for instance, it's all about the juror, whether we're talking about jury selection, or we're talking about closing argument, we're talking about any building the case, it should be about building the case for jurors. Right? I mean, we can't forget that we're not building the case for, you're not building the case for just anybody, any audience in the world. It becomes very specific to what the jury is who you're going to try the case to. And so you have to make it okay in jury selection also. I mean, part of like, even if you go to like Nick Rowley's brutal honesty thing, or you go to a number of other people's sort of signature beginnings of jury selection, what it's all about is making it safe to say what's really on your mind as much as is possible, right? So the quickest way to do that is to model it in a vulnerable way. And that's also true, by the way, in closing argument, when you're concerned about, them going back and closing and having a discussion about some X thing, which is bad, right? Or you think is bad. You model it by saying something like, I'm not the strongest guy. And if I were on the jury, I might have a tendency to start letting my mind drift to X. And while I know that that's human, I also know that that's not a proper thing to consider in a case like this if I'm a juror. And so I would need my brothers and sisters on the jury to come beside me and hopefully gently but firmly remind me that that's human. It's perfectly human, but that's not appropriate for here because I don't want to wake up 2 weeks from now and realize that I reached the wrong verdict for the wrong reason. I want to know that I reached the right verdict for the right reason. I don't want these things that are not supposed to be a part of it to interfere with me. So I'm putting it on me, but I'm doing it in a way so that the jurors are then empowered to say, well, he's just like I am. And to I call it normalizing the behavior, normalizing the thought process. Might be something as simple as, no amount of money is going to bring Johnny back. Or it might be something much deeper than that. Something like in that case involving the Muslim family, I owned to the jury. I said, I fly on airplanes every week. And if I got on an airplane and I saw my client stand up at the wrong time in an airplane, I can't help my eyes from watching. And I can't help my old law enforcement self from thinking certain things. And I can't stop my body from positioning myself for the takedown if necessary. And I don't like what that really says about me, but it is my truth. And I'd be lying to myself if I didn't say it. And now I feel so exposed because I'm a professional in this community and I just admitted that I'm really kind of racist. And I'm not sure what to do with that, but that's part of my truth. And so I'm going to own it.
So you say that whole thing to a jury?
In that case, I told in the closing argument, I said, I can't help it.
Wow.
And I told him I was upset with them about jury selection because none of them opened up about these things in jury selection. And I didn't do jury selection in that case. My law partner did. And everybody sat there like this in jury selection when asked questions like, is anybody concerned about, money leaving the United States because they're Muslim? Anybody here worry about Al-Qaeda cells? I mean, nobody opened up. And I told him in closing argument, I was upset by them. And I think that what I was trained is that when I get upset to first look inside, and when I looked inside, what I realized when I looked inside is I'm not sure that I would have had the courage to say anything, but here's my truth. And that's when I said, I can't stop myself from. And so I think I would have sat there
I mean, that is such a powerful thing and a very, very hard thing. I don't know if I would have the courage at this point to do what you did in closing argument. I mean, that really does take a lot of courage, but it's also very liberate.
You're either a hero or a dumbass, Dan, depending on how the outcome is. You know,
yeah. But let me ask you, I mean, in jury selection, would you do it that way? I mean, would you say that in jury selection?
So another case, the one that I really learned about this idea about was a case that I tried where I was in sort of ICE capital of Georgia at the time, and I represented two Hispanic people. One was documented, one was not documented. And they literally told me, I came in the case to try it, and they said, you know, we're just not paying the money because we just don't think anybody in this community is going to pay these Hispanic people any money. And I was like, what? Are you actually going to say that out loud to me? I mean, like, yeah, they were brazen about it. But, and it started out, jury selection started out in that case by, with the first juror. I mean, I started out by saying, you see that my clients have these things in their ears. There's an interpreter back here who's repeating everything that is said here in a way so that they can hear it and understand it. And they speak a little bit of English, but not enough for a courtroom. And so what does that make you think? And first person raised their hand, says, makes me think they're illegal. Are they illegal? And I said, well, Judge, can I answer that question? No, Mr. Freed, you know, you can't answer that question. I said, well, I can't answer that question. I said, what does that make you feel? And he said, it makes me know they're illegal. And I said, okay, well, let's say they're illegal then. What then? He goes, well, I'm not giving them any money. Then the guy next to him was nodding along. I said, I see, sir, you're nodding along. He said, yeah, a quote, damn Mexican ran over my brother and didn't have any insurance. And a Korean lady on the third row raised her hand and said, you know, I learned how to speak English. And if you can learn from Korean, and that's about when the judge pulled me up and said, are you trying to bust the panel? And I said, no, Judge, at least these people are talking to me. And so what I learned in that case, and it's become one of the most powerful features of my jury selection, is how powerful the oath is. I learned that people who have very strong convictions about some of the things that we're talking about, and some people might call that racism, some people might not. I'm not making a judgment about it because, frankly, making a judgment about it is not helpful to us as trial lawyers. I live in the world that is. And so as a trial lawyer, I just try to be an observer of that world to some degree. And then how do I work within that world? And what I've learned through some pretty broad-based research is that people who have strong convictions about things like we're talking about have just as strong, in fact, stronger convictions about their oath that they take. So in other words, when I was able to come back at the end in jury selection in that case, look at the first juror who spoke to me and said, okay, so look, if you're going to be on this jury, you're going to have to take an oath. And the oath is going to, it's perfectly okay to think the things that you're thinking. I'm not here to change anything about, I have strong feelings too about things, but you're going to have to take an oath to set those things aside in rendering your verdict in this case, or else you're going to violate your oath. Sir, are you going to violate your oath? And you say, hell no, I'm not going to violate my oath. I say, how can we be so sure? I'm not violating my oath, especially not for those people. Right. So think what's happening here. I mean, trial law is a game of psychology at some level, right? So what's the only way that he can prove to himself and the world that he didn't violate his oath?
Harry, what are your thoughts on the oath move?
Well, I love how, and one of the things I try to incorporate, especially when you have, you're trying to get jurors to feel comfortable admitting things that you and I know are a bias, and Joe, you know are biased, but you don't want to tell the jurors that they're biased, is saying, you know, the aspect of, hey, we're humans. I mean, I like to, some of my voir dire, if I'm trying to voir dire them on, you know, a particular law that they probably, some of them probably won't agree with, I don't like to say, here's a law, you got to follow it. Who can't follow that law? And you're not going to get too many people raising their hand. But when you tell them, you know, the law and the judge is going to say, you got to do this. But we're human beings, and it wouldn't be fair to try to force a human to enforce a law they don't agree with in the first place. And so I think reframing all those things around that Joe is describing around, you know, the problem is not with you as a juror. You're not some defective juror who has defective values or anything. It's like we're human beings and we have our beliefs and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's the only way you're going to get them to be honest, right? Because if you say, hey, here's the law, who can't follow it? You're going to get a lot of arms crossed. And, you know, because in their minds, they think, if this is what I believe and I'm fair, then I'm going to give a fair verdict. And in their minds, you know, a fair verdict is a tiny verdict, or a fair verdict is not giving any money to somebody who's a legal immigrant or whatever they feel. So I love that, you know, Joe was saying, here's what the law is, but here's what human beings think, and normalizing it is great for them. And if you can use yourself as an example, that really is great at breaking the ice, because otherwise you're asking your jurors to do a lot if you're asking them to be the first person to step out there and say.
I don't think I think it takes a very special person to do it, right? I mean, so actually, Dan, the idea comes from the world that you and I met in, which is sort of the psychodrama, you know, kind of a world. I mean, what makes psychodrama so powerful? First is that it creates a safe place. And then the next thing it does is it starts to normalize vulnerability. So you get up there and the psychodramas that you've been a part of that have been the deepest and the most meaningful are ones where early on somebody broke the ice with something very vulnerable. I like the term shockingly vulnerable, kind of like brutally honest. To me, the word is shockingly vulnerable. If I can get up and be shockingly vulnerable with somebody, then that sets the tone for, number one, it makes it okay to be vulnerable. And number two, it takes a lot of the stigma of being a trial lawyer and what that means to a lot of people and kind of turns it on its head. Because if he's willing to admit that about his case or about his situation or about himself, then he's not what I thought he might be as a lawyer. So you kind of go off code pretty quickly when you start to, and it's not a game. I mean, that's really my truth. I mean, my truth is I need that. I've learned that I need the shocking vulnerability, which means I need a challenging juror. I need somebody who's going to call me out. What I used to dread, which was the juror calling me out on a personal level, saying, you're a greedy son of a bitch, you're a fucking trial lawyer, you know, yeah, whatever is embodied in that.
Ambulance chaser, all the, you know.
All the stuff. Right. You're unfair, you're bad, you're a wart on the values of society. You make ladders longer because they need more warnings. You know, I mean, whatever, every lawyer joke. I now need that. I need that in order to own my truth. And what used to be an effort to deflect and defend has become something that allows me to show something that's real. So if you challenged me and said, if a juror challenged me and said, you know, you're just a greedy lawyer, the current version of me would allow myself to feel that as deeply as I could feel it and then respond from that place. And it's not a defensive place. It's the place from which that's true. So I'm responding from the place of saying, you know, you're right. There's a part of me that is exactly what you're accusing me of, and I've been working on it. I'm 30 years into this practice, and there's still a part of me that is that. I guess that's just the human part of me.
Let me ask you, Joe, what do you do with a juror who tells you, you know, as a human being, I don't feel that this or that is right, or I have an issue with, you know, who your client is, or I have an issue with big damages or whatever it is, and they tell you, I think I can probably set it aside. I mean, do you take them at their word? Do you keep them? I mean, obviously, it's one thing with the people who say, nope, it's going to interfere with my job and I'm just not the right juror for this case. But what do you do with those folks who, you know, they say they can do it, but I know when I'm in court and I'm seeing someone, I have big concerns about whether they can actually do it or not. How do you handle those people in voir dire? And how do you decide whether you keep them or not?
Well, I don't know that there's an always answer, Harry. I wish I had a system that was better, but I'm going to try to have a real dialogue with the person. Number one. And part of that is going to be to try to show my vulnerability and say, you know, I don't get a second chance at this. If we impanel the wrong juror, then I've lost before I started, right? And so is it wrong for me to be worried about you on the jury? So how would you respond to that? How would that juror respond, Harry?
Most of them, well, I mean, yeah, some will tell you, yeah, you're probably right. And then they give you permission to kind of push them off on that path for cause. And some will say, I'm just one of the ones who go, you know, the ones who say, no, I don't think so. But they've maybe said some things that, you know, you're like, oh, those are pretty strong convictions that are kind of dead set against my client or what my case is all about. And then you got to obviously a judgment call. But do they have to really convince you that they can set it aside pretty absolutely for you to keep them?
It's a great question. And, you know, I'm of the mindset I'm looking for a reason to keep people, not a reason to strike people. I know that that's one way we could divide the world of lawyers. And are you an inclusive or an Yes. exclusive person when it comes to jury selection? And so for me, I would say I would not retreat from the person. I think the biggest place that we've come into problems is we start demonstrating who we are to the jurors, to all of the jurors, because of that one juror. So whether I'm going to strike that person or not, they're not going to know I'm going to strike them. I'm going to say, so I have a fair shot with you. And so that's all I'm asking for, is a fair shot. And as long as I have a fair shot with you, then I'm good with you. Kind of that's the energy that I'm going to bring to the table. Because if even if I strike the person, I think that I've got an amazing opportunity in that moment to demonstrate to the jurors that I'm not afraid of somebody having different feelings than me. I'm not afraid of somebody saying to me, as a general rule, I don't like big number verdicts. As a general rule, I don't, you know, I mean, whatever that is, because I found that those people, a lot of times, those people have given me the most money. And I'm not trying to change their mind about something. So I don't know if I'm answering the question, but I'm staying with the person. I'm not jumping to an immediate decision about them. And I'm hopefully, if I have an opportunity, I'm going to continue to dialogue with them very honestly and show, hey, I'm concerned. Because what I really want at the end is I want that guy with his verdict to prove that he did what he promised me he would kind of do. Same thing with the oath. When that juror says, I'm going to follow my oath even if I have to hold my nose. Okay. Are you throwing that guy off or not? I'm not.
It's funny, Joe. I was going to go back to that one because I feel like you almost did by going from the guys like these damn Mexicans or whatever they're saying, and then you then throw the oath at them. You're almost rehabbing for the defense. You've already, like, you're doing literally what a judge would do to rehab that juror, right? Like, can you follow an oath? And I'm curious, why go there? Like, what's the, I mean.
Because my whole strategy in that case, Dan, was, look, I was in a tough place from a venue perspective. My whole point was, what am I making the case about? I got up then, so can we agree that, I mean, imagine your sort of, quote, worst juror, and they've made a commitment that they will follow their oath, even if that requires them to hold their nose to do. They will follow their oath. What if opening statement was, somebody here is going to try to get you to break your oath. It's either going to be my side or their side. And honestly, that's what this case is going to be about. Look for one of us trying to get you to violate your, look for it during this case. Look for it as the evidence gets presented. Look for it. And then the closing argument is, I told you somebody was going to try to get you to violate your oath. Let me show you the ways it happened. Boom, 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 boom. What are you going to do? What's the case about? At the end of the day, folks, this case is about a wreck. But what it's really about is, how are we as a society going to live when it comes to the way we're going to resolve our cases? They know that they're not supposed to do. They're not supposed to play on this thing. They know that they're not supposed to try to get you to violate your oath. Your verdict is going to say either keep it up, keep it going, keep doing that, or it's going to say don't ever frickin' do that in this county again, right? And it's as close to a send the message kind of a verdict as you can without hopefully violating rules. And some people would say that's over the line, and I'm going to leave that alone. People make their own decisions on.
I've never heard anyone use the oath so strong.
Oath has become, it's almost every case now.
You mind if I explore that a little more? First off, just for our listeners, can you describe what, like, or give an example of when you say an oath? So what is this oath that you're really getting at in jury selection that the jurors should follow, or that they're going to commit to following?
That they're going to decide the case based upon the facts and the law, and they're not going to allow certain things to interfere with that, like prejudices, like sympathy. I always use sympathy first because it's the one that everybody agrees to on both, you know, and it's part of the jury charge, you know, alone, right? It says we're not supposed to make decisions based on sympathy. So it's perfectly human to be, you're a human being. You're a sympathetic creature. You're going to have sympathy. It's conceivable you could have sympathy for both people in this situation. You can have sympathy for a witness in this situation. You can have sympathy for anybody. And there's nothing actually wrong with having sympathy. That's human. What would be wrong is if you allowed sympathy to cloud what you're really here to answer, which you're here for a very specific purpose. I always remind jurors, and I start in jury selection, reminding them that their job is a very specific job to do in a case. And we're going to keep the case defined. We're going to keep their role defined to that which is their responsibility. So now we go forward from that, and they've got a very specific job to do, and it doesn't include, so I can tell you, Dan, it's perfectly okay for you to think some of the things like, where's the money going to come from?
Exactly. That's the one I was going to go to next. You have a 16-year-old driver.
I have a list for every case. I have a list of all the things that I would be concerned about and that I think other folks might be concerned about that are what I call my list of human things that are not supposed to be part of what a jury considers. And there's always an element in my closing where I'm talking, which means there's always some discussion about this to the degree that I can in jury selection in, you know, where I get to say, you know, so you want to reach the right verdict for the right reason. So how do you make sure you do that? Well, there's all these human things that might pop in, that might interfere. And they're perfectly human. I mean, it would be weird if it didn't happen to at least some of you on the jury.
Because they're not robots. It's not a vacuum. This is they're supposed to be human beings.
And so, but here's the thing. Do you want to wake up a week from now or even tomorrow morning after the verdict's done and you can't do anything about it and realize that you violated your oath because you allowed some of this stuff to come in? You didn't even realize you were doing it. That's what it is to be human. Do you want to realize that? Or would you rather have somebody come beside you if they thought that maybe you were thinking about some of these things that you're not supposed to, and gently but firmly say, you know, I think you may be delving into that no amount of money is going to bring Johnny back thing that we were talking about. It sounds like that in what you're arguing here or telling us about here. And, you know, respectfully, that's not where we're supposed to be.
I love that because that's something that I've been telling just recently, actually, in the last couple of months, I've been telling some of my clients who have cases, especially against individuals, and it's not a company, and you can't talk about insurance, and they're worried about where the money's coming from. And we hit that hard in voir dire and everything, and we can talk about that another time. But what I like to tell them is, and it's similar to what you're saying, in closing, get up there and say, basically, it should be a fair verdict of what you think it should be, and you need to give a verdict where you're going to have no regrets. After this case is over and you've given your verdict and you're outside talking to us in the hallway and maybe you find out more information that you weren't supposed to consider, that you don't have any regrets and say, oh my gosh, if I had just known that. And of course, when I say that, you know, we're really talking about where's the money coming from, insurance, but it should be the right verdict where you're not—
What about saying it right out? I think a lot of lawyers think, well, if I say it out loud, I create it in the jury. It's already freaking there.
Right.
I mean, so calling it out actually takes the power away in my experience from it.
In California, at least, I think there's a fear among lawyers. If you even say the word insurance, it's going to be a mistrial motion. Oh, but yeah, but where the money's coming from, for sure.
Yeah. But if you say where the money's coming from, I think you could say that anywhere.
I think you could.
Nowhere should you probably say the word insurance, but you can get close to it.
Yes.
By saying, where's the money going to come from? Or how is this going to affect Billy Jones, this 23-year-old young man? And some people might say, do I want this following him around for the rest of his life? How is this going to hang over him for the rest of his life? And what's that going to be like to hang over? I think about that, but that's not what this case is about. And so you have to now say, I'm not going to be a juror in the ways that we need you to be in this case because I'm going to allow this. And that's the wisdom of the law. That's why the law says these aren't the things that should be considered. You're not going to hear anywhere when the judge tells you what to consider and what not to consider. You're not going to hear any place in there where the judge says you should consider how this is going to affect Johnny for the rest of his life.
I assume you always have a section where you talk about oath in jury selection.
It's almost always because it's become part of my way that I argue cases and the way that I want jurors to be. You know, jury selection to some degree involves putting lenses on human beings through which they're going to see the case. And that's the beginning of the lens, right? The beginning of the lens is that. So I have found for me that the oath provides me with a lot of ways to go. And sometimes the whole case, what I've told the jury about, the whole case is really about the other side's going to try to get you to violate your oath. It can be a very powerful thing.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to hear about how the oath and how you use it in case you have to get cause challenges. But we want to take a quick break. We want to thank our wonderful sponsors. First off is Baldwin Settlements, fantastic structured settlement company with the founder and owner, Melissa Baldwin, who gives back all the time to the plaintiff's bar with CALA, CAOC, AAJ. She really is the go-to structured settlement company in person. Baldwin Settlements, they work with clients to really get them set up for the rest of their lives. I worked with her on the big damages case where we represented someone who was seriously injured, but his demons, he was a drug addict, kind of in and out of homelessness, got him a big settlement. And she was able to speak at his level and convince him that he needed to have a structured settlement to get himself set up for his himself and, you know, his siblings who were taking care of him for the rest of his life. And she's just able to really relate to these clients. And not only does she relate well with the client, she's very accessible. I mean, she will text, call when she's on vacation, nights, weekends, which is what you need with a structured person. She can deal with mediators, the other side's structure person. And she can also get great rates on attorneys for their fees. So I highly recommend the Melissa Baldwin, Baldwin Settlements, very dear friend of mine and a huge supporter of the plaintiff's bar. So Baldwin Settlements, thank you for sponsoring.
And for their contact information, just reach out to Dan or I at Picking Justice if you want contact information for any of these folks, because they're amazing. Our other sponsor, Motion Lit, I mean, they do it all. They're technically like a trial technology company, but they do what? Settlement docs. Let me know if I'm missing anything, Dan. Settlement docs, trial technology, animations, graphics. What am I missing here? I'm sure there's a couple other things.
I mean, I've worked with Motion Lit for a very long time. Vahe and Vache, they're wonderful people. They really understand what it takes graphically to tell a plaintiff's story in opening, closing, any imaging you need, animations. We use them a lot for surgery animations because not only are they really good and accurate, they have a great team of animators, but they're also affordable. Frankly, like their prices are hard to beat. And we've shopped around, you know, but we love Motion Lit. We love their work. Jurors love their animations. So they got all tech support, depositions, like you said, settlement videos. Their animations are fantastic. Just really good people to work with. And they're huge supporters of the Plaintiff's Bar. And I think it's important the business partners that we team up with, that they support what we do and our causes and all that. And Motion Lit has always been there for that. And they're just really good to work with. And just like Melissa Baldwin, they're very accessible. They're just good dudes. Vahe and Vache from Motion Lit.
And involved in the Altadena fire litigation because they actually lost their office in the Altadena fires. Their office was in Altadena. So get in touch with them for that case or any other trial that you got coming up there at motionlit.com. And they're terrific.
Yeah, no, they're great. And then our final sponsor, who's new to Picking Justice, Four Corners. It is a deposition summary company. We have been using Four Corners in my office for, God, it's probably been 8 years, maybe more. Really just a fantastic company that they will summarize your depositions quickly. We literally, every time we come in a case, because we get a lot of cases referred from other lawyers where depos have been taken, we just immediately, right away, send them all our depos and we get these great, accurate summaries back quickly. And they just make it so easy for any firm, frankly, that is litigating cases, but especially trial firms. If you have a case where you have, you know, 10, 15, 20 depositions, you really need a good summary so you can get up to speed quickly. We love their summaries. I mean, Frank, KTL, we use them for every single case, all summaries. We trust them with the work. They're quick, they're affordable, just really good, like I said, good people to work with, big supporters of the Plaintiff's Bar as well. So Four Corners, I highly recommend getting all your depots summarized by them. Even on cases that you have, as soon as we take a depo, we have a standing order in our office that as soon as the depo is done, as soon as we get the transcript in, my team sends it to Four Corners, get summarized, and then boom, we are just ready to rock and roll for trial or preparing for other depositions. So Four Corners deposition summary is fantastic. Harry, you have the contact information for them?
I do. Yeah. If you want contact information for Four Corners and their owner operator, Sheila, who is amazing. Yeah. Reach out to us and we'll get it to you.
All right. Thank you to the sponsors, Baldwin Settlements, Motion Lit, and Four Corners. All right. Let's get back to the show. I liked how you described it as there's kind of a dividing line on trial lawyers with some it's deselection, some it's building the tribe, inclusive jury selection. You obviously fall in that second category. And if I'm a trial lawyer who falls in kind of the first category, bringing up the oath, I think it would really prevent me from getting cause challenges. Do you, just as a philosophy, do you get cause challenges?
I do get cause challenges. So the goal of the cause challenge is obviously, one, you're going to get the juror off. But secondly, I'm always very concerned about what's the group dynamic. To me, the group dynamic is more important than a specific juror getting removed.
Elaborate what you mean by group dynamic. I want to hear a little more what you mean.
The group dynamic, what I mean by that is simply what's going on in the room. What am I modeling? If I have to become somebody who I don't want to show up as in order to get somebody off the jury, I'm making a conscious choice that I don't want to do that. I'll take the peremptory, you know, assuming I'm not in Arizona or wherever. You can't do that anymore. So there's not an always rule. But I ask for cause challenges, but it's usually very apparent when we get them, right? I am spending more of my time trying to keep jurors than trying to push them off. I think that when you are going to push them off, the hard part, the thing that you have to do is obviously lock it in, right? Because the judge is going to come back almost everywhere that I've ever been, and they ask, they try to rehabilitate the juror. I think you can do a lot to counterbalance that, depending on the judge, because you can quickly run afoul of a judge pretty quick where you try to tell the judge, don't rehabilitate my jurors, and they tend to have strong feelings about that, right? So I think you can say something like, nothing, we've had this great discussion, and you've demonstrated how you feel, and you feel pretty strongly about that. Yes, yes, and there's nothing I can do to change. I've not tried to change your opinion, have I? No, and there's nothing I could do even if I did try. I could be the best lawyer in the world. I could be the judge. I try not to say that, but I could be anybody, and there's nobody who's going to change that position that you have. You feel it very strongly. You felt this way for a long time, and it's part of the fabric of who you are. It would be unfair for somebody to suggest that you should set that aside.
But explain to me how you're tying that into, like, so you have a juror that's really bad, like the example we used earlier, the one who's just like can't stand the illegals or someone
needs to speak
English.
That person was the fourth person of the jury who gave me a record verdict in the case. I did not,
which that's incredible.
I did not strike that juror.
Yeah, but you have a juror who kind of gives that answer, and then you'll go into the oath. But then explain to me, how do you weave in the oath with jurors that you have gotten for cause?
Honestly, the oath piece is the part to keep them, right? Because the case becomes, if you're using that in the way that I was in that case, the oath becomes, because I'm planning on actually using the psychology of the person who would typically be saying, yeah, I'm against this, but I'm for the oath even stronger than I am against that.
You're kind of framing it that way, like the oath, and you're kind of almost asking them, right? Is your oath more important than these other feelings that you have? Or
that's right. I literally said, are you willing to follow your oath even if you have to hold your nose to do it, right? And so in that case, I'm not weaving it in. I'm probably not the best guy to talk about the, you know, striking people for cause. So it's pretty apparent in my cases, I'm about rehabilitating them. And I know that that's not what the rest of the world is about, and that's fine. I mean, I do things a little different. When you get to a point that you want to, or when you can, before we run out of time, I would like to talk about one concept of jury selection that I think is underappreciated, or at least not thought about.
Well, can I ask you one more question before we move on, Joe? Because I'm super curious to ask you. I just want to see if you kind of do it the way that I do it. You know, we talk in this podcast a lot about what we've changed in our approach over the years. And I think all of us, if we're progressing, we look back, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years on how we were doing it. And we go, what the heck were we thinking back then? We do it totally differently now. And so one of the things is I wanted to ask you is, in your voir dire, when you're voir diring the jurors, do you talk first in your voir dire about some of the important values and concepts in your case, if it's a trucking case, about safety and or whatever your case is about, before you talk about the biases? Because that's what I do now. I think that if your case is about whatever it's about, you don't want to just, you know, very first thing bring up, how do you feel about Mexicans? How do you feel about Muslims? How do you feel? Because those are, that's not what your case is about. So I used to do it that way. I used to say, let's first talk about all the biases that I'm worried about. And then only then do we talk about the core values of the case and talk about trucking safety and driver safety or whatever it is, or employment rights and things like that. What's the order of your voir dire generally?
So Harry, it depends a lot on where I am, because increasingly in late years, I mean, it's just the way it's been. I've been in places where my length of time that I have to do jury selection is really, really limited. And so I'm finding that I'm jumping right in to the fear points in the case right from the beginning. I'm usually almost making an excuse for it, saying like, folks, I don't have a lot of time to get to know you in the way that I would like to, but here's what is on my mind. We've got this situation in this case. Should I just pack my stuff and go home? And we get right into it. If I had an unlimited amount of time, what I want to always be is intentional about the warm-up that I'm creating. Right. So I want to create something real and meaningful early for the reasons that we described. I talked about a little bit earlier about the idea of group dynamics. In my experience, anytime I've ever run a group, I've run lots of groups over the years, whether it's jury selection group or it's teaching trial lawyers a group. If I can get to something that's meaningful and real early on, and we have a real conversation, I pull everybody in, and we have an amazing experience that we co-create in the courtroom, right, or anywhere else. So whatever it is, I want a real issue. I don't want a whole lot of light foreplay. I'm going right for into something that feels real, because I think people are starving for real.
Especially nowadays, I think they want
crazy. Yeah. It's crazy how much they want to see that. So when they see something, I want juries at the end who say, I can't wait to see how this thing plays out. Like, I want to come back and see how this starts to play. And so I'm not really answering your question, but I'm trying to. I think that in all my cases, I do believe, and I think you believe this too, most trial lawyers, they start their preparation for voir dire by pulling out their last voir dire. And if they've never done a voir dire, then they pull somebody else's voir dire, which is even worse, right? And they just ask the questions that are on the list. And if you ask, so what I always tell people to do is first step is take out your voir dire that you intend to use and ask yourself really why any of the questions you're asking, how do they really help you pick a jury? Because most of them are fodder. For most people, in the way they even ask questions about bias, they don't actually get the information that they need about the bias, in my opinion. And I'm not saying I'm holier than anybody. I make all kinds of mistakes. But to me, the question really becomes, if this is an exercise where I'm supposed to select or deselect people, then how is this going to help me do that? Other than somebody asked this, I saw somebody get up on a stage and say, you should always ask this in jury selection and do it this way. And so I do it that way because that's what I've been told. So that's the first piece of it is that. The second piece is now let's get very specific to the case. What are the things that are the key things, whether they're indoctrination type questions, which go to, like in trucking, the concept of safety, or whether they're death shots or whatever the Rodney Jews of the world would call your things that if Mark Mandel calls it stuff you can't get over, you know, I mean, things like that. But I'm finding that because I'm willing, I use as the technique with a judge, I will trade time, length of time, for type of voir dire. So if I have a judge who says you have, you know, you're going to raise paddles and you're going to ask questions and you're going to ask these questions first and then you're going to ask follow-up questions then, or it's going to be, you know, we're going to pull six people up and you're going to ask them questions and then we're going to pull another six people up and you're going to ask them questions. I'll trade and I'll say, Judge, I know that your primary concern is judicial efficiency. Yes, what if I ask you if you would allow me to do it my way, but and I'll do it in 1 hour. Would you consider allowing me to do it my way, which is going to be to have an open dialogue with people? And so if I have an hour, you know, then I've got to get right down to business because an hour goes by really, really quickly, as you know. So those are the very long-winded response to your...
I always like to hear how people's processes are specifically. Like when you're getting ready to prep your voir dire, do you put pen to paper and say, I'm just going to put a list of the danger points? Do you write out your questions? What's the Joe Fried kind of method? Just really from pen to paper to you asking the question.
Well, I think that I definitely do. I write out questions because I do believe that it matters how to do it. It doesn't necessarily mean that I follow it exactly because I'm going to be led by the jury to some degree in where we go. But I definitely think through conceptually what are the key points that need to be addressed if possible, if I have time to address them. Here's the main ones. And here's, I spend a lot of time thinking about the way that I'm going to get into the subject matter and how can I use some of the things that I've learned about being vulnerable and about creating a safe place for people to talk about tough issues. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about the introduction into the area.
Yeah, the segue, the kind of, yeah, all that stuff. I agree. That is important.
And Harry, I do think about the order as well. I mean, I do think about it. And what I found is that my whole life as a lawyer and probably as a human being has been an exercise in fear management. And so I'm very conscious about what it is that I'm afraid of, become conscious of it. And I've kind of made friends with the idea that that's instructive to me. And what I don't want to do is avoid because of fear. So I think the challenge in the case, as much as it is pen to paper, what you were suggesting, Dan, it's actually addressing some of those things. What's really going on with me So I can be present in the way that I want to most be present when I get in front of a group of people for the first time. How do I want to present myself? What state, emotional state, am I going to be in?
Yeah.
And I'm very, very conscious about that more than ever before now.
That's good. Yeah. So in the last little bit here, Joey, you said there's some things you wanted to talk about that you think is underappreciated in jury selection.
Yeah. So I think a lot of us spend a lot of time on the bias questions and a lot of time on questions within the idea of bias, especially on damages, on the idea of, you know, we break things down by saying how many people here have strong feelings about economic damages or about giving awards for money for pain and suffering or whatever those kinds of questions that we've been taught to focus on. And what I think we forget to focus on, or a lot of people do, is what are you making your case about when it comes to the damages side of a case? So if the case at the end of the day, I don't care what the injury is, TBI, spinal cord injury, even a whiplash, I mean, whatever it is, what are we really making the case about matters. And I'm going there in jury selection. And so here's what I mean by that. We talked about earlier that people are largely the same in most ways, and then there's some ways that in which they're different. But I already know, no matter how conservative or liberal a jury, an area is, I'm going to have differences of opinions on lots of things, but there's some things that are not. So, for instance, take any case, I don't care what case you're thinking about, but if I ask you about if at the end of the day I'm going to be asking for a lot of money in the case, anybody who's going to award a lot of money, they're going to have to award it because what was taken away was very, very important, right? Very meaningful and very important. So I already know what those things are for just about everybody in the whole United States. It doesn't matter where I go. So I've built my case around these universal things. And now when I go to jury selection, I start oftentimes now by saying, so what I'd like to start talking to, this case about some things that this case is going to be at the end of the day, a case where you're going to be asked for money. And money is kind of like the equivalent of value. And so I'd like to ask you, Dan, and I'm going to ask you as if you're a juror, and tell me the couple things that are most important, most valuable in your life.
My wife, my kids.
Your family.
Family, yeah.
Hold on. Mr. Plotkin, juror number two and juror number four, can we agree that that should be on our list?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's make a list right here. Family. If it's not number one, is there anybody it's not number one for? Everybody says number one. Okay. What's something else, Dan?
I love the work I do.
The work you do.
Yeah.
Mr. Plotkin, what do you think about that one? Does that deserve to be on the list?
It's on my list. I would say health and quality of life and being able to enjoy the things that I like doing, or, you know, whether that's work or hobbies or whatever it is, it's the quality of life. And
quality of life. But you said a couple things there. You said health.
Health,
and health is important to you because, at least in one way, it's because it allows you to do things in your life.
Yes.
What do you think, Mr. Kramer?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been dealing with terrible back pain, chronic back pain, and it's not fun.
Yeah. So let's put these things on the board. We're not going to worry about whether it should be number one or number two or number three. And we can go through a jury selection like this, and we will create a list. And I can steer it a little bit. Like if I said to you, how about the idea of being able to choose for yourself how you spend your time? Yeah, should that be on the list? I can force feed it. But by the way, usually you don't have to force feed it. If you get enough time, the same things are going to come up everywhere. And like I said before, freedom may come in the form of my pickup truck and my 357 Magnum, or on one side of the country in one part of the world. And in another part of the world, it might be a sailboat or my camper. Well, what's behind camper? Freedom. So how about if we go the other way? And I said, what are some of the things that would be the worst things? How about having to be dependent on the people who you love most?
Being a burden, yeah.
Being a burden.
Losing my mind.
Losing your mind. Okay, we put that on there. How many people agree? So by the end of jury selection, this can be done very quickly. By the end of a very short jury selection, I have a list that the jury created of the things that are most valuable in life. Well, folks, what you're going to find out about in this case is about this. It seems on the surface that it's about this broken arm, but it's really not about a broken arm. It's about how it affects the family. It's about how it affects freedom. It's about how it affects these things. So what I'm suggesting is that you can, to some degree, through the jury selection process, and I'd ask people to do is bring your creativity to the table, because this is actually can become very fun. If you bring your curiosity to the table, but you've also spent time thinking for yourself, what are the things that are universally true about people? I mean, that's one of the great things about focus groups is you can learn there are really things that everybody cares about. You can use jury selection as a way to preload the things that are most important and most valuable. And then those are the things that you've built your case around.
That is beautiful. I'm definitely going to steal that. So you're writing it down, and then once you've kind of got your, so you've done this with what, probably like 8 jurors, the jurors in the box, or just a few jurors?
However many jurors you have, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, right.
List, what you keep doing is you keep going to the big group. Does that deserve to be on the list? Does anybody think that one shouldn't be on the list? Okay, no. Can we agree? So that's got to be there. If we're going to end up with 10 things, would it definitely be one of the 10? Or does anybody here think maybe it should be, I don't know, maybe closer to 20 or something like that?
So you've done all that. And then what's the next step?
First of all, this would fall into what I think Harry was talking about earlier, sort of an indoctrination question that's a little different than safety and trucking. It's the idea of setting up. So here's what's going to happen is, look, we're here about freedom. And so what is always the case then is that we're here because they don't think there's big value to that. And I say they're wrong. And I don't get to make the decision, but I can't let them make the decision either. That's why we need you. So you get to decide for this community, are these concepts, family, freedom, not being a burden, da-da-da-da-da, are these things valuable in our society?
So everyone says yes, and then...
So now you're going to get an opportunity to work that now into the actual case, right? So now the argument down the line is they don't think this is valuable.
Right.
I think it's very valuable. And we can still argue about what does that mean, very valuable. I mean, is that $100 million or is that $1 million? But at least we've gotten sort of a big step in the right direction where they created the list.
That's great. But I'm wondering, do you at any point ask, do you tie that exercise to talking about millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars?
I personally am doing less of that.
Less of that.
I know that other people do it very effectively. I do less of it. And of course, it depends on where you are, how much of that you can do. Like you could very easily, though, tie this in and say, okay, so if when you think about these types of injuries, if the evidence supports a $50 million verdict in this arena, would somebody hesitate to award it? Or those types of questions.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Depending on your venue, I think anybody who watches this, who's watching it in a national audience, I think you have to be careful where you're going. And I'm sure Harry will back this up. You got to be really careful in where you're going, what you're allowed to do in that regard, because you can find yourself in the mistrial very, very quickly.
And then if the judge says, counsel, you're preconditioning, what's your response to the judge on that?
Preconditioning on what?
On when you're asking about, you know, what's your list? What's on the list? Have you gotten that objection or has the judge attempted to shut that down?
I don't think there's anything inappropriate.
I don't think there is either. I'm just curious if you have.
So I think where you're more likely to get that is if you start to now say, now who wouldn't give $10 million?
Right, right.
Now you're crossing into an arena. But I think universally anywhere you go, as long as there is jury selection available to you, you can explore people's feelings about the things that are going to be mission critical in the case for which you're going to be asking money.
Yeah. Last question, because I know we're tight on time here, but and this is just, I could go for another 3 hours, honestly, this is amazing. But I just want to hear what's your philosophy on not bringing up millions of dollars in jury selection as much anymore?
I'm not sure I have one. I mean, I wish I had a clean answer for you. I do tell jurors we're going to be asking for a lot of money. We do tell them it's going to be millions and millions of dollars. So it probably does come up in my jury selection. I'm trying to think of in what ways it has.
But you used to do it more, like you'd highlight, we're asking for tens. Yeah.
But I will tell you that my philosophy now is it's one of the first things out of my mouth in opening. We're here and I just want to get one quick thing out of the way. I'm going to ask for $27 million in this case at the end of the case. I want you to know that, right? Before I say anything else.
Wow.
Good morning, $27 million.
Wow. So you do specific amount.
Very specific.
And there's a dividing line with trial lawyers on that too. There's some.
There is, and it's all fear-based. I mean, yeah. it usually the pushback that I hear is, what if
the case goes bad?
Dot, 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 right? I mean, what if dot, dot, dot? It could be a couple of things, but that's what it is. So the way I do it is I say, look, if everything goes the way we expect it to go during this trial, I'm going to ask you for $27 million at the end of this case.
And here's why. And then you.
No, okay. No. If something changes, I'll be the first one to get up here and tell you why it ought to be a different number at the end. Okay, that gives me the saving grace to come back. And I have had to before. Well, you know what? We thought Dr. So-and-so was going to say such and such, and he didn't say such and such. And therefore, you have to make an adjustment. It wouldn't be right for us to leave the numbers where. And so I think there's a credibility to coming in and to making a change. In fact, I think that credibility is so important that, I mean, it's not something you should be afraid of, getting up at the end and saying, you know what, I was wrong. When I asked for 27, it should really only be 25. Because you have to take this surgery out. I mean, there's enough to leave it in if you really think you should, but I think you should take it out. I think you should reduce the number from 27 to 25. So I think that those are important things.
I mean, I could have a whole, I would love to almost have a whole podcast just on understanding your philosophy on why you structure your opening that way. We don't have time today, but we're definitely going to have to bring you back for
I will tell you this, Dan. I believe in most parts of the country, again, it depends where you are, because some places you have to do certain things in order to keep your verdict to support it. But I believe less is more when it comes to arguing the reason for damages. The truth of the matter is there's always a disconnect. Whenever you get into non-economic damages, by definition, they're non-economic. And you're asking somebody to convert non-economic to economic. So there's always a disconnect. At some level, there's got to be a leap that's not really logic-based. And you're trying to create logic in a place where there isn't logic. And so what I found is that what's most important is to be credible, right? So when I'm credible and I've lived credibly in the courtroom and I say $27 million, then people are willing to accept my number. And what I've learned the longer I do this is people have no idea whether something is $2.7 million or $27 million.
That's what Carney Shigarian is, an amazing employment attorney out here. He's a great trial case all the time. And he's got a very matter-of-fact approach. He's not one of these like, you know, very flamboyant.
Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, he is. And I've heard David DiRubertis, another amazing employment attorney. And he says the one time he's so credible and calm and kind of like low tone throughout trial. And the one time he puts it on the line, he says, in this case is worth $28 million at the very end. And just puts it on the board and then sits down. Doesn't explain it.
That used to be me. It used to be me. And now I do it in the opening.
Yeah.
And one thing I always teach lawyers about it is like, think about it from the juror's perspective. Like, if you have confidence that something's worth $20 million, you don't have to sell it super hard. And actually, the harder you sell it and you say, it's $20 million, and let me tell you why, and you go into this
You give three reasons when one reason would have been good enough?
Yeah. The more you're selling it, the more I think your jurors are feeling like, he's selling it to me. And when Carney, or I'm sure you too, Joe, when you've built credibility throughout the case that the defense has not, and you tell them this is what it's worth, and you don't argue it and you don't have to feel like you're selling it, you've got their credibility. So I always tell people, you know, how do I explain these big numbers and what formulas do I give them and everything? And I go, be careful on overselling it because jurors can tell when you feel like it has to be sold, if that makes sense. So
I agree. And I think for those people who this sounds really, really scary to, which it should if you've not done this.
Yeah, I'll tell you I'm one of those because I have this whole new formula where I break down the past non-economic damages. My non-economic damage awards have gone much higher now. I mean, this is very interesting to me and, you know, I'm persuaded.
I'm actually in favor of breaking it down and having people see these are all the things that you're giving.
So you do break it down at the end.
But I don't give you a specific line. I don't tell you how to define it. So like, in other words, for non-economics, you know, let's say there's humiliation and disfigurement and all these words, right? I'll put all of those there. And I'll say, it's because this person is this age and they've gone through everything that you've heard about in this case. And we could go through and I could tell you how much line item. Some of you will agree more here, more less here. Da-da-da. That's not what I want you to focus on. This is $27 million. However you want to add it up, it's $27 million.
So you don't put a number on each. But you do tell them they can do that.
Consider it. You know, do all this kind of stuff. But it comes up to this amount. But here's what I was going to say before. For those people who have a fear about this, and it's very natural to have that fear, I continue to have that fear, it's a really good way to use some kind of a focus group to practice getting the words out of your mouth and get it out and then get behind the glass and see how people deliberate about it. And the clue that I'll tell you is you have to believe it yourself. You have to do the work to believe it yourself. The way to get there is not to just force yourself to say a big number, like I've heard lots of times. in my opinion, the way to do it is to really make it personal. And think of the person who you love most in the world, the person who's most vulnerable in your world, and this is what happened to them. What would you be wanting for them now? I mean, whoa, shit, if it's my kid.
Yeah, golden rule yourself, 100%.
Yeah. Now when you get up, now you can look people in the eye and you say, this is the value of the case. And then see what it feels like to not become defensive and to not feel like you have to explain it. And then just get behind the glass and listen to what their reaction is. And then call me and tell me what you think about the idea of not having to explain it.
I do like, now I do 6 to 7 focus groups for every trial. And I'm going to do that. I have a trial coming up with Harry. It's coming up in a few months. And I'm going to do it. And I'm going to see what it feels like. And I hope to be calling you and celebrating with you, Joe Fried.
I want to hear about it. Look, if your experience is something different, I'm very interested in that too. This is all work in progress. The reason we're on this together is we're trying to learn from each other.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been really amazing. I knew it would be. Joe Fried from Fried Goldberg in Atlanta, Georgia, my hometown. Go Braves. Cannot thank you enough, Joe. This has been fantastic. Harry, as always, this is a pleasure. Thank you to Law Pods for putting this on, for giving trial lawyers who have never been in a courtroom an opportunity to hear from the greats so that they can be themselves and get out there and try cases. Everyone out there, try cases. It really is the best thing to do. It's the best way we can all get justice for our clients. You know, all boats rise the same. So thank you, everyone out there, for listening. Thank you to Law Pods and our sponsors. Joe Fried tries cases everywhere. If you ever have a trucking case, I've hit him up anytime. He's always available. He's always willing to mentor and help people. And that's what we really appreciate, Joe. So thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for picking justice. We'll see you next time.
If you're enjoying the podcast, the best compliment you can give us is sharing it with a colleague who would find it valuable. For all the best clips from the podcast, follow us on social media. You can find those links in the show notes. Have a jury selection story to share? Email us at podcast@pickingjustice.com and we may address it in a future episode. Until next time, remember, you're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.